This is Dr. Laura Calkins of the Vietnam Archive at Texas Tech University, continuing the oral history interview with Lieutenant Colonel John Yule. Today's date is the 18th of August, 2005. As usual, I'm in the interview room in the Special Collections Building on the campus of Texas Tech, and I'm speaking to John by telephone, and John is over in the Fort Worth area. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Laura.
It's a pleasure, as always, to speak with you. And today we're going to start with a discussion about your arrival in Guam. And this is in 1972, and I believe April. You had told a little bit about your receiving orders out of Carswell Air Force Base. Did you know why you were going to Guam?
Yes, but the way that worked, Laura, was I had, just to back up a step, I had finished my Vietnam tour in C-130s in July of 71, and that's when I was assigned to Carswell. And I was getting up, recurrent in the B-52. I'd flown the B-52 from 1960 to 1966 at Altus, Oklahoma.
Right.
So it was just getting recurrent in the airplane, and I, in the process of doing that, and then I went out to Castle Air Force Base for a for a D-model training, and that was, I think, in the winter of 71, then came back in 72 to Carswell from Castle, and that was just a two-week or a three-week TDY. And my first tour of on alert at Carswell Air Force Base, in the middle of the alert tour, and these were seven-day tours, in the middle of the alert tour, the wing commander came out one evening to the alert facility and said, okay, guys, we're shutting this place down. All of you go home, go into crew rest, pack your bags for a warm climate. And the rumor was pretty strong already by that time that probably more B-52s were going to be deploying to Guam and Utapau, Thailand. And that was exactly what it was. We were progged to go, I think, in May. My crew was on the schedule to go in May. I received a phone call from the scheduler a couple of days after we'd come off alert, and he told me, get your crew ready. We're going to have to send you early. And the reason was another guy who had been in Vietnam at the same time that I had, I didn't know him, but he had the same background as I did. He'd been in B-52s, been to Vietnam, and was getting recurrent, but he had a problem refueling, and he couldn't refuel, so they couldn't send he and his crew over if he couldn't get the fuel, because you have to refuel to go from Guam to Vietnam.
Was this a mechanical problem or a skill problem?
Skill problem.
Okay.
Just because they kept putting him up, riding with instructor pilots, and he just couldn't get the fuel. And it's just a matter of ability to aerial refuel.
Okay.
So they said, you're going to have to go a month early. So we did, and we arrived there just after Linebacker 1, and Linebacker 1 was when the decision was made to bomb Haiphong, bomb the harbor, and we were just, I and my crew was not involved in that. We were there flying missions out of Guam and Utapau. We, let's see, who, I know my nav didn't go, oh, my new crew. I had a captain, co-pilot, a first lieutenant navigator, a lieutenant colonel, bomb aimer, the RN, the radar navigator, a lieutenant colonel, EW, and a, I think he was a tech sergeant gunner. The gunner and the navigator were new. The nav had just finished nav school. Gunner had just finished gunnery school. And so that was my crew.
And, John, just for the record, would you go ahead and just give their names?
Yeah, the gunner is Gary Morgan, and the radar navigator was Lou Bernasconi. The navigator was Bill Mayall. The electronic warfare officer was Bill Conley. And my co-pilot was, drawing a blank here. I'll think of his name here in just a second, but I'm just picking.
That's okay.
Dave Drummond. Thank you, Rose. Dave Drummond.
Go Rose.
Yeah, go Rose. There you go. Good girl, Rose. Yeah.
Well, now, these guys were already had been working with each other. How did they react to you coming in as the pilot?
Well, my first impression was kind of business as usual.
Yep.
But I have to share with you a little story about Lou Berlusconi, the radar navigator.
Okay.
Of course, he was a lieutenant colonel, as I was. I think the co-pilot and the nav probably were not too sure, me being a lieutenant colonel and one of them being a captain, the other one a first lieutenant, that they probably weren't too sure about me until they got to know me. But Lou Berlusconi had no such problem. And after our first mission out of Guam, he came up from his seat after refueling, came up front and told me, he said, John, he said, you have no idea how glad I am to have you on this crew. He said, that is the first refueling that I've been through in months where I wasn't strapped, ready to eject. He said, oh, it's going to be so nice having you refueling. So I felt real good about
that. That was pretty. Yeah. He was reassured, and you felt pretty good about it,
too, I'm sure. So, and as it turned out, the crew chemistry worked out to be very good. And I got along very well and with them, so it was fine.
Now, let me ask about this the period just before Linebacker 2 started. What did you find out in the way of briefings as to the change of policy?
You mean with Linebacker 2?
Yeah.
Okay. Standard operating procedure over there was you flew in out of Utapau, you flew every day.
Okay.
Like 6 or 7 days in a row because the missions were so short. Mission was only two and a half hours. So it was really, it was almost exactly an eight-hour day. From the time you left your trailer and until you got back in your trailer after the mission was usually just about 8 hours.
Okay.
Of course, this eight-hour period was around the clock. I mean, you might, one day you might leave the trailer at 8 o'clock in the morning. The next day you might leave it at 11 o'clock at night. It just depended upon where you were in the rotation because they were flying cells all the time. And so that was pretty much the procedure. You could count on 6 or 7 days in a row, then 3 or 4 days off, then 6 or 7 days flying again. That was just the procedure. So the way it worked for us as far as the timing worked out, when, and I'm trying to remember, Laura, who went with me to Patty, I know the radar did. I think probably the EW. I don't know. There was. I think there were either three or four of us. I know my navigator didn't go, and you'll see why in just a minute.
Okay.
But at any rate, we do our 2 or 3 days at Patty. We come back, and we notice something has certainly changed. There's just a different atmosphere about the base when we come on the base. It might have been the guards at the gate when we came on, but it was apparent that something was up. Of course, we're listening to the news all the time, too, and the latest news we'd heard was that the talks in Saigon had just fallen apart, that Kissinger had gone back to Washington mad because Who was the
President Tu?
No, it wasn't Tu.
Nguyen Khoa Ky.
No, it was after that. Was it Tu? Maybe it was Tu.
I think so.
Yeah, it was Tu. Yeah, you're right. I'm thinking. You know who I was thinking of when you said Tu? I was thinking of Kai, the pilot.
No,
it was Tu. You're right. Tu. Tu said, "No way, we're not going along with this deal." And Kissinger was all bent out of shape. He huffed off and went back. So that, we knew that. As far as the news was concerned. Then, coupled with the atmosphere on the base, what I suspected is what came to be. I mean, I thought, uh-oh, we got a problem now. And the first person I ran into was my nav. And I asked him, I said, so what's going on here, Billy? And he said, I don't know, sir, but he said, everyone's restricted to the base, and you have to be in uniform. You either have to be in your flight suit or in a uniform. And I thought,
mm-hmm.
We were scheduled to fly the next morning. So I called scheduling, and I said, just wanted to make sure we're still scheduled in the morning. He said, oh, no. He said, you're not flying. And I said, what about the other cells? And he said, nobody's flying. Everybody's standing down. And that never happened. They never stood the cells down. So that was assurance that something big was in the works. And we went to this briefing, and I don't know if I told you this. I might not have told you this story. This is something that I mentioned in almost every speaking engagement I have.
Okay.
I mentioned this.
Uh-huh.
A typical mission briefing for the typical missions we were flying in Vietnam up to this time were in cells, 3 B-52s, 6 people on an airplane, so there's 18 people at the briefing. And the way SAC operates, rather than just briefing in a little flight planning room or something, no, you briefed in the big theater. And so you've got this huge theater, and you've got the first 3 rows are occupied
mm-hmm.
for the 3 B-52 crews. And then you got all these briefers. Well, a typical problem was, and I did feel sorry for the briefers, because nobody was paying any attention to what they were saying. Everybody was talking to each other, and the biggest problem the briefers had was trying to keep control of those 3 crews. And usually it was something along the line, the sooner you guys shut up, the sooner you're out of here, and
mm-hmm.
that's usually what shut us up. So now you got the picture of what a typical
right.
briefing was
right.
all the time. Okay, now we go to this briefing. And I guess I need to back up a step. They did publish. They got a hold of everybody and told them what their schedule was. And so we were told that we were going to be wave lead on the second wave out of Utapau, the first night of Linebacker 2, the 18th of December. So we know that we're going to Hanoi. Well, no, we didn't know we were going to Hanoi. We just knew we were going to go fly. We did not know what the target was.
Okay.
But there was no question in almost every crew member's mind. It was one of the 2 H's. We were either going to Hanoi or Haiphong.
And just for context, both of those had been previously banned as targets.
Well,
with the
exception of Linebacker 1, which was in April
right.
or May of 72 when they mined the harbor in Haiphong.
Okay, right.
And that was the only exception for buffs. Now, you know, they'd hit them with they'd been up there a few times with the fighter bombers, but not with the buffs.
But not with
right. I think as far as we ever went with the buffs, except for that, minus that one exception, was to Vinh. I think they did fly some missions to Vinh occasionally, but
okay.
But essentially, you're right. We Haiphong and Hanoi were off limits. So this was the first time we were going to be going to Hanoi, but we did not know that as we left our trailers to go to the briefing.
Okay.
Now, mm-hmm. The briefing. In the theater again, but this time the theater is packed with crew members because this is a wave of airplanes, a wave being a series of cells, and a cell being 3 B-52s, and a wave was comprised of X number of cells. So with a divisible by 3, you might have 18 to 21 to 24 to 27 airplanes in a wave, depending.
Mm-hmm.
And so you've got a lot of crew members in this briefing room. The briefer could have briefed in a whisper without a mic, and everybody would have heard every word. It was so eerie quiet. I mean, it was interesting. And, again, in speaking engagements, I always ask people if they've ever seen one of my all-time favorite movies, 12 O'Clock High.
Mm-hmm.
Does that ring a bell
yes,
with you?
Yes, it does.
Okay.
Uh-huh.
I love that movie. Of course, I'm a big Gregory Peck fan anyway, but at any rate, mm-hmm. there's a scene in that movie when they're going on a particularly difficult mission, and there's a scene where the briefing is taking place. And that is what flashed in my mind at that briefing. I thought, my God, this is what it was like for those 8th Air Force guys flying out of England in 42. Only there, with them, every mission was like this. And for us, this is the first one, but it was, that's what it reminded me of. It was really a sobering experience. And it sobered more after the briefing, and of course that's when we found out we were in fact going to Hanoi. But as we came out of the briefing, and it just so happened that the first aircraft from the first wave were landing and coming in to debrief.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember in the hallway meeting some of those guys. They didn't say a word. I didn't say a word, but looking into their eyes, I knew that it was going to be an exciting evening. It was just eerie experience. So that's how we found out what we were going to be doing, and that, so we took off, I think, probably around midnight, 1 o'clock in the morning, somewhere in that area.
Mm-hmm. And this is on the 18th?
18th, yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And we go, we do our thing, and our target the first night was Hanoi Radio, and that was our target for ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And we took it out of commission for, I think, about 24 hours, and then they were back up again. So that didn't work out too well. But anyway, let me go through, if you want, I'll go through that.
Yes, please, John.
Okay. We came in, the route of flight was west of Hanoi, quite a bit west of Hanoi. And when we got a beam or just a little bit north of Hanoi, then we turned back to the east, and that was our bomb run heading coming in. And we, it just so happened there was a jet stream at about our altitude, so we were really smoking into Hanoi. And I knew we were the third wave of the night. The first wave had taken off from Utapau, the second wave from Guam, and we were the third wave.
Okay.
And so I was expecting to see a lot of activity as we were coming into the target. But we're coming in, and we're 4 or 5 minutes up away, just out from bombs away, and everything's quiet. Nothing's happening. I thought, wow, this is really weird.
Meaning you can't see anything?
Well, nothing. I don't see anything. I don't see any sounds coming up. I don't hear anything. It's just like a normal training, not a normal training mission, but a normal mission prior to Linebacker 2, until I'd say we were about 2 minutes from our target.
Mm-hmm.
And then what appeared to be flares were being, it looked like someone was out lighting a flare. There was an undercast, which there was every night.
Mm-hmm.
And just you'd see this bright light diffused a little bit by the clouds. And I thought, what's this deal with the flares? And then those quote-unquote flares broke through the undercast, and you could see that there was a rocket plume from the SAMs that were coming up. And there were a lot of SAMs on their way up to us. And so for the next minute and a half, 2 minutes, it was real exciting with all the SAMs coming up and trying to avoid them and all that good stuff.
What did that look like coming at you?
Well, like I say, the thing you see is the only thing you could see was the rocket plume in the engine.
Mm-hmm.
You couldn't actually see the SAM itself.
Mm-hmm.
And you just saw them everywhere. And it was frightening. I'll tell you, frightening. And plus, you're maneuvering to get away from them, but you know that the last 30 seconds of the bomb run, you've got to keep that PDI centered, because that's when the radar is on the target. The needle that you're keeping centered, the pilot is a function of that tracking handle that the radar is putting on the aiming point. So you've got to have that needle centered that bombs away if you're going to hit your target.
And did you have to do that regardless of whether you thought one of those
plumes was coming
right at you?
So the procedure, my procedure was,
mm-hmm.
about 30 seconds prior to bombs away, I'm keeping the needle centered as best I can, and keeping an eye out for SAMs, and who's helping me, of course, is my co-pilot
mm-hmm.
and the gunner, because the gunner can see SAMs, too. The gunner, as I said, was a new guy.
Right.
And every SAM that he saw, he called, which was wrong, because I finally had to tell him. I said, Gary, don't call every SAM you see, because I can't be turning just because you see one. You're going to have to make a determination as to whether you think it's tracking our airplane or not. and same for the co-pilot and myself. And if we felt one was really locked onto us and tracking us, then we would take evasive action.
And would the electronic warfare officer be the one to actually...
He would be the one, that's right. And he would be the one that would say, activate, you know, evasive action now. He could. He was a primary guy,
mm-hmm.
but we hadn't heard a word out of him, nothing, and which is another story.
Okay.
But at any rate, the procedure I kind of developed for myself was, with 30 seconds to go, I just kind of look out over the nose of the airplane to see if I saw any SAMs that were a direct threat, and then I just concentrated on the on keeping that PDI centered. And let the co-pilot and the gunner call the SAMs, plus the EW.
And, John, let me just stop you right there to ask. You're flying in formation in a cell of three,
mm-hmm.
So you have some limits on what you can do.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. There are limitations as to what type of action you can take.
Uh-huh.
And, let me correct one thing, Laura.
Sure.
I'm getting ahead of myself. I'm thinking night four when we got shot down.
Okay.
As best I can recall, the EW was directing me to take evasive action that night. He was seeing the SAM signals. He was doing his thing.
On the first night.
The first night,
mm-hmm.
yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So you're going in at
let's say you're at 30 seconds now and you have decided that you're going to hold on.
Yeah, I'm going to just focus on keeping the PDI centered and not be looking for SAMs.
Okay. 30 seconds.
Yeah, so we drop our bombs, and then we do a breakaway turn.
And what kind of, was it a banking?
Yeah, about 60 degrees of bank.
And up?
No, just turning.
Okay.
Just a turning. Level turn,
okay.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
yeah, and we're at about 35,000 feet.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're turning south to head back to Utapau.
Right.
So we do that, and we get back and land, and it's morning. We debrief, we go to our trailers, and then we go fly the next night. Let's see. I guess this would be as good a time as any to.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that I usually mention in my talk speaking engagements is
mm-hmm.
about the way that briefing affected me.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things it left me with was, I said, you know, I'd been flying airplanes at that time. Let's see, this is 72, so I'd been flying airplanes for about 15, 16 years at that time, and I had never had the feeling I had in that briefing room that night. And, again, this relates directly to that movie, 12 O'Clock High.
Mm-hmm.
Because as I was in that briefing room looking around at all those other guys, I thought, you know, some of us are probably going to be dead in about 2 or 3 hours. If you're a statistically oriented person, you just figure the odds are
mm-hmm.
some of us aren't coming back, which turned out to be the case. But that was an eerie feeling, too. I'd never experienced that in my life.
Even during some of the flights that you've described earlier.
Yeah. Well, most of the other flights, you know, if something happened, like my first tour in Vietnam, we got shot at a few times.
Sure.
But usually you kind of had the feeling like, well, the odds are definitely in my favor. I mean,
mm-hmm.
the odds are that I'm not going to get shot down. I might get hit, but I'm not going to get shot down. I never really gave it much thought. But this I did because of the odds. Mm-hmm. I just figured, we're going to Hanoi, and this many B-52s, I just have to believe some of us aren't coming back. And that was the case. Some of us didn't come back. But what a sobering experience. And like I say, I had never experienced that before. I had one, and I think we talked about this one. I told you about the flying airborne alert and the moon coming up.
Yes, uh-huh.
Yeah, That was a bit similar.
That was a scary.
That was probably the scariest feeling, as far as feeling like it's over.
Mm-hmm.
That was, I felt it more then than any other time. That was it
mm-hmm.
When I saw that moon. But this was a little different in that, just realizing that looking around that room, that some of us were going to be dead in 2 or 3 hours. That I'd never really experienced
this
that.
This is much more on the sort of on the individual level where you're looking around at the faces.
Yeah, yeah. And so anyway, that was a rather sobering experience.
Well, John, what about the debrief when you came back? Can you describe what happened?
I do not remember much at all about the debrief.
Mm-hmm.
What I do remember is primarily they were interested in the SAMs. About the SAMs, how many SAMs.
I'll bet they were.
were we.
Yeah.
But the other thing they were interested in was the chaff, because we had F-4s laying chaff for us.
Mm-hmm. At about what altitude, do you know?
I would guess 25,000, 30,000, somewhere in there.
Okay.
But that was, in my opinion, it was a totally useless operation. To me, the first problem with that doing that is if the North Vietnamese were wondering where we were going to be coming from, they sure as hell wouldn't be wondering after they saw this string of chaff in a line.
Right.
I mean, that wouldn't take a mental giant to figure out where the airplanes are coming from. That's the first problem I had with that strategy.
Mm-hmm.
And then the second thing is, by the time we got there, the chaff was dispersed anyway. So the chaff really, I think it was more of a hindrance than a help. The other thing that was talked about was, and I think I'm remembering this correctly, I think that they wanted you, the checklist called for you to open the bomb bay doors 60 seconds before bombs away.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess the reason was if there was a malfunction with the doors, it'd give you 60 seconds to figure out something, get the doors open before you drop. But there's an automatic system on that airplane, primarily for nuclear weapon delivery. And if you put it in the auto mode, it would automatically open the doors 5 seconds prior to bombs away.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of us, including me, chose to do that. We didn't want open bomb bay doors the last 60 seconds of the bomb run. So there was discussion about that policy.
Can you explain why you wouldn't want those doors open?
Yeah, because it's just going to give the SAMS operator that much better a target with all those bombs. Boy, what a reflector that is.
Yeah, they can hone in on that with more effectiveness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so anyway, that was the other thing that was talked about at some length was a breakaway turn. We didn't like that breakaway turn because the jet stream, when you put that airplane up into a bank, you effectively block out your electronic countermeasure equipment. So at the most vulnerable point, when we're in that breakaway turn, now our ECM, our electronic countermeasure equipment's no good. And with that jet stream, it just about stops you. You just about park the airplane there in the most vulnerable position.
And so, can you explain what, just in very sort of brief terms, outline terms, what the electronic countermeasure, is it the profile of the plane that is disappearing on the radar, or?
No, it's more of a jamming thing.
Oh, okay.
What you do is the electronic warfare officer, he's briefed on frequency bands that the SAMs operate in,
mm-hmm.
and there's also a difference in whether they're in the search mode, i.e. looking for you, as compared to when they go to the tracking radar when they lock on to you.
Okay, right.
And then also when they launch. So the EW, he can tell those three things. He can tell if they're searching, if they're tracking, and if they've launched the missile.
Okay.
And
when you go into that bank turn.
Yeah, he'll call that after it's launched. Let's see, what else? But that's essentially what the electronic warfare officer, and he can, that's what he can detect. But he has jammers. He can jam. He can... If he gets a signal, he can jam it, which then makes it very difficult for them to do whatever they're doing. I don't think our equipment was that effective against breaking lock. I think once they locked onto you, it was very difficult to break their lock.
But in the period before that...
When they were searching, you could cause them a lot of trouble.
By getting on their frequency and...
Yeah, and jamming, because then all they're going to see is a lot of ground, what looks like ground clutter.
Okay.
And they can't pick the airplane up from the ground clutter.
Okay.
That's the beauty of having an effective jammer. And the other thing was we did have chaff dispensers, so we could dispense chaff on our own. And some of the airplanes had flares for heat.
Mm-hmm.
That's essentially what they did. Now, the breakaway turn, Laura, was a very effective tactic against a single SAM ring. When we used to go just into North Vietnam and hit targets maybe 50 or 60 miles north of the DMZ,
mm-hmm.
these targets were usually defended by a single SAM ring.
Meaning a series of sites located around...
Yeah, I shouldn't say SAM ring, just a site, a SAM site.
Oh, okay, SAM
just
site.
Just one
okay.
SAM launcher with however many SAMs they might have at.
Okay, sure. Okay.
And what was an effective tactic was, as you're going into your target, if, say, the SAM, and normally this was the case, the SAM site was usually very close to whatever your target might be. So as you're driving into your target, If you went into this breakaway turn right after you dropped your weapon, you could essentially, a lot of times, you could stay out of their lethal range by doing this sharp turn. You wouldn't get in close enough to where they could really lock onto you. So it was very effective against a single SAM site. But then when we went to Hanoi,
mm-hmm.
where they had, I think, 12 or 13 SAM sites, now what you're doing is you may be breaking away from the lethal range of one SAM site, but you're just a sitting duck for two or three others.
Right, you're heading right into
yeah,
it.
Yeah, yeah, you're just sitting there for the others.
Sure,
so,
okay.
So that was not a good tactic against multiple SAM sites,
mm-hmm.
but that's what we were briefed to do.
Mm-hmm.
However, they did change that tactic. And another thing that we didn't like was all of us coming in from the same IP, the initial point, which just made it that much easier for the SAM operators, if all the airplanes are coming from the same point. So one of the changes they made as a result of debriefings and hearing what the crews had to say, they made two significant changes. One was they came in from multiple IPs, and they eliminated the breakaway turn. You just overflew your target. And then, in fact, the first night that procedure went into effect was the night we got shot down, and it was just before our target that we got hit. So anyway, we got the change we wanted, but it didn't help us any.
And that was on the fourth night?
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, mm-hmm. The second night was similar to the first night. Our target was a thermal plant north of Hanoi. That was the easiest mission, the second night. Third night, we didn't fly. We were what they called the NIF cover, which the acronym means duty not included flying.
Okay.
And that meant that if, for some reason, somebody that was scheduled to fly that night couldn't fly, then you would substitute for them,
okay.
whatever the crew position
so
might be.
So you were kind of the sort of second tier.
We were the backup,
mm-hmm.
backup crew,
mm-hmm.
and it wasn't we weren't really backing up a crew. We were backing up individual crew members. For example, if that third night some pilot had said, I'm sick, I can't fly, then I would have gone and flown his crew in his place.
And was that, from your point of view, smart that you could be sent on these kind of missions flying with people you'd never...
Yeah, no, I didn't have a problem with that.
Oh, okay.
I didn't see that as any... Although SAC's philosophy wasn't... And I agree with SAC's philosophy.
Uh-huh.
SAC was very big on the integrated crew concept.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
They believed that it made... And I agree with them. I think it did make sense because it's just like the analogy would be a sports, Texas Tech. You know, if you've got a bunch of guys that have played together for 3 or 4 years... They're going to work much better as a unit
right.
than if you got all new guys
right.
that have never played with each other. And it's the same way with a crew. So that was good, and I agreed with that concept, but I also didn't have a problem because SAC was so standardized. Everything was standardized. So it really wasn't that difficult to step on an airplane, even if you're the odd crew member, and fly and be effective.
You could be assured of some consistent level.
That's right, yeah.
Performance.
You wouldn't be quite as effective, probably, as an integral crew that flew together all the time, but you wouldn't be far off.
Got it. Okay. Mm-hmm. So that was the third night. You were ready to go, but you did not have to go.
No, none. In fact, nobody on our crew did.
Okay.
Which is another thing that I always like to point out in speaking engagements was One of the big concerns, and I'm sure this goes way back to Cain and Abel, one of the big concerns that the staff had about the new crew members, well, yeah, they're okay now flying these milk run missions, which is all we flew up until Linebacker 2. But they said, what if we really get in the fight? What if we really get into it, and how are they going to perform? Well, the answer was, I submit, when we were to NIF cover that third night, mm-hmm. and nobody on my crew had to go fill in for anybody. In other words, everybody was stepping up to the plate. They were doing it. And I was really proud of the young guys that they came through like they did.
Mm.
So that's an aside.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But it also shows in some ways, talks about the esprit de corps that
right, exactly.
That was already, I mean, it had obviously taken a lot of training to get to that point, but it was in place when it needed to be.
Yeah, and I'm like I say, it must go back ever since there's been war.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure that the command level people are always concerned about the troops. Are they going to perform or are they going to cut and run?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's a natural concern that you would have as a commander. And I think that in the normal day-to-day activity, when, these young guys are doing some dumb things and they're probably thinking, what the hell we got here? And but, boy, it really made you proud that when it came time to do the job, they did it and did it well. Let me see here. I need to weave in another little story. This story is Little Things Mean a Lot. What seems to be just small, little, insignificant things that
mm-hmm.
turn out to be huge later on.
Mm-hmm.
I briefed my crew when we got out the airplane after we knew we were going to Hanoi.
Mm-hmm.
I briefed my crew. I said, okay, guys, here's the deal. We are going to stay with that airplane. If we get hit, we're staying with it until it blows up because it's not going to do us any good to bail out because I don't think they're going to be taking any prisoners. I mean, we're bombing Hanoi. We're bombing their capital. So even if we successfully get out of the airplane, and I was talking about in the immediate Hanoi area.
Yes.
If we could get out away from Hanoi, then different story. But I said, if we get hit right over the target, we're staying with the airplane until it comes apart because I don't like the alternative. And so that's what I briefed him, and that's what I fully intended to do. The night that we were shot down, at the briefing, an additional optional briefing item, which didn't have to be briefed but was this. They said, by the way, Captain Hal Wilson, his radar and his EW have been captured. They are alive. They were captured, and they are prisoners of war in the Hanoi Hilton. Well, that really, I thought, wow, I am surprised to hear that. I was surprised. I didn't think they would be taking any prisoners. And any rate, I know now, in hindsight, that I filed that away in the back of my mind because when it came time to make the decision as to whether to get out of the airplane or stay with it, I know that was a factor in my decision to bail the crew out. So what scares me is when I think, what if they hadn't briefed that night? What if I didn't know that when we took off? And when mm-hmm. the situation arose and I had to make a decision as to whether to stay with the airplane or get out of it, what would I have done? And what would have been the end result? So
sounds like part of a plan, though.
Yeah, what our initial conversation,
mm-hmm.
huh?
Yes,
yeah,
exactly.
Yeah,
yes,
yeah.
Exactly.
But, boy, it still brings chills to me when I think about that.
Was Captain Wilson someone that you knew?
Yeah, I did know Hal.
Uh-huh.
In fact, just talked to him a couple years ago, and he ended up in 111s and ended up in Albuquerque.
Mm-hmm.
He's not there. Well, he's just outside Albuquerque, but my radar, Lou Bernasconi,
mm-hmm.
that's where he lives, is Albuquerque. So got together with Hal a few times, but I did know him.
So he had, just to clarify for listeners, had been, his aircraft had had taken fire one of the previous nights.
The first night. He was shot down the first night.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So within 3 days, they had hard information that he was a POW
and where he was. And briefed it to the crews, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Did you and other members of the crew or other of the pilots and personnel at the briefings talk about that, or did you it just...
I don't think so. As I recall, Laura, that's an excellent question, but I don't remember that we did. I would think we would have, but I just don't remember. I'll tell you one thing. It was pretty quiet around there.
When
you were on the ground, there wasn't much conversation. Another interesting story. Do I have the stories or what?
You sure do, which makes this, of course, a terrific interview.
After the first night, the next evening, before we went to fly, we were having dinner at the Yo Club, and one of the other pilots made this comment. He said, "Well, I'll tell you one thing." He said, "If I get shot down and if I have to bail out, I'm taking some of those North Vietnamese with me. I'm gonna shoot as many as I can when I get on the ground." And so now fast forward to about 2 weeks before we were released, the last group to come out of Hanoi.
Right.
And one afternoon, for whatever reason, I still to this day don't know why, but for some reason, they let all of us in the zoo, that camp, get together for about, I would guess, maybe 30 minutes or an hour. They let us all get together in the courtyard, which was the only time it happened, and it just happened for a short time. But who do I see but this guy? And we just made eye contact, and I'm sure I had this smile on my face.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, like, tell me again how you're going to take... And we never said a word about it.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
well, thank God he changed his mind.
Yeah, isn't that the truth? Yeah, it's funny how when it comes right down to it, you might have a different view of that thing.
Yes.
And now one of my favorite stories.
Okay.
All-time favorite stories. Guy by the name of Bill Elander. Bill Elander and I were in pilot training together. At the time, I went through pilot training. Miss Rose and I were married, and we had one daughter and another one that was born while I was in pilot training. But anyway, the point is I was a married guy.
Mm-hmm.
Elander was a bachelor and a very, very good friend of mine to this day who I went through cadets with way before pilot training, Bill Beyer. He was also a bachelor, and he and Elander were good buddies. And when I was at Utapau during Linebacker 2, Bill Beyer was also at Utapau. He was in MAC, and he was working in the MAC command post at Utapau.
Mm-hmm.
He was on his way back to San Francisco the next day, and this would have been like the 19th or 20th. And he made this comment to me. I had dinner with him before he went back. And his comment to me was, he said, "Now look, Boz," he said, "if you get shot down in this thing and if you get captured, be sure you look up Elander because, you know, he was shot down and captured this summer." And I said, "Oh, yeah, Beyer, that's exactly what I'll do. If I get shot down, if I get captured, trust me, the first thing I'll say to that camp commander is, my buddy said that he wanted me to say hello to Bill Elander. Can I see Bill for a minute?" I said, "Get out of here, Beyer. Go to San Francisco, you idiot." So, at any rate, back to this two-hour time when they let all of us mingle.
Right.
Who do I run into but Elander?
And that's unbelievable.
You got to know this guy, Elander, Laura. You would love Elander. He was a Thunderbird pilot. And he's just crazy as hell. Just a wonderful guy. And Elander, I see him and I go up to him and I say, "God, Elander, am I ever glad they let us get together here. If we never get out of here, at least I can do..." I said, and I told him the story. I said, "The night I got shot down, I had dinner with Beyer, of all people." And I said, and Beyer's comment to me was, and I told him, And so I said, if we ever get out of here, Elander, the first thing I want you to do is call Beyer and tell him that I did as he asked.
You took care of business.
I took care of business. I looked you up, and I said, now, Elander, he says, okay. He said, now, look, he said, now, remember, he got shot down in June or July of 72, just 6 months before we were shot down.
Mm-hmm.
And here's his comment to me. He says, Boz, he said, we've been noticing you new guys. And I said, new guys? I said, what the hell do you think you are, Elander?
Yeah.
Like, you think you've been up here all your life? He said, well, we're old heads compared to you new guys. And I said, oh, the hell you are. And he said, well, one thing we don't like, he said, we noticed looking out from our building, we saw one of those guards slap one of your guys, hit him, and he said, the guy pulled back when he hit him. He said, that's not the way we do it up here. He said, and he acted it out. He said, we throw ourselves into those punches. He said, we show those guards how tough we are. He said, if they hit us, throw yourself into these punches. And so I said, yeah, okay, Elander, I think I got it. I'll go back and share that with all the guys in our building that we're doing it wrong. Well, now, fast forward to, gee whiz, not too many years ago when we were at, we had a reunion in Seattle.
Mm-hmm.
And we were going up, you could opt to go on a cruise. After the reunion, they had a cruise for whoever wanted to go on it.
Sure.
Up to Alaska.
Uh-huh.
Well, Bill Elander at that time was a president of the Chamber of Commerce in Anchorage. He was out of the Air Force, and that's his civilian job.
Okay.
So he was the guy chosen to get us lodging in Anchorage because we bussed up from the cruise ship up to Anchorage. And so we ride on the bus ride up. I'm telling all these old heads this story I just told you.
Mm-hmm.
So we get to the hotel where we're staying, and who's out in front meeting and greeting but Elander. And he's shaking hands with each POW and his wife as they come off. And I step on the step of the bus, and Elander looks up at me, and I'll tell you, Laura, we couldn't have scripted it better. Neither one of us said a word. All he did was make a motion with his head like he was throwing himself into a punch. And you should have heard all those other guys on the bus. It just broke them up.
Wow. He sounds like a great guy.
Oh, he was. And this guy Beyer, too. So, at any rate, that was another interesting little story from that couple hours that they let us all get together.
And that was about, what, a month or so before they let your group?
No, it was just a couple weeks.
Oh, was it?
Okay. Yeah, because we were all in that, let's see, I think there were, the zoo, see, they had positioned us, so all the guys in the zoo at that time were late shoot downs.
Yes.
So all of us came home either on the last airplane or the next to last airplane.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So just before they released us is when they let us have that time together. But anyway, that's a big diversion from where we were at. Let's see, we were somewhere around night three or night four.
Yeah, we were about. I think you were about to run out to the plane on night four.
Night four was. There was another big change here.
Mm-hmm.
Night two? Something. I can't remember the details, but there was some crew that got the airplane back. They made it back. I think they made it back to Da Nang or someplace, or maybe Utapau. Anyway, they brought the airplane back. They landed, and they told them that, hey, you guys can sit out the rest of the war. You know, you've had your deal. And they wanted to go fly the next night.
Mm-hmm.
Which was our night four.
Mm-hmm.
And so the wing commander said, all right, if you guys want to fly, you can be wave lead tonight. So for the first time, we're not wave lead. We're back in the pack. And ironically, that's the night we get shot down. So, but that night was just more or less, this night was not that much different than the other three, except for, of course, the two Silver Sams. But the big difference here was when I went through my procedure again about 30 seconds prior to bombs away.
Right.
And I looked out over the nose of that airplane, and there was a SAM, and I just couldn't believe it, just under the nose. And all I could think about was, I thought, just detonate above us, because the pattern on those SAMs when they detonated was upward and conical. So if the SAM detonated above you, you probably were going to be okay. But if it detonated below you, it's a direct hit.
Because the debris is coming up?
Yeah, everything, all the shrapnel, everything's coming up just where they want it. Mm-hmm. And the next thing that happened, that was my thought, the next thing that happened was the airplane goes up in about a 30-degree bank. All the windscreens completely shatter, but remain intact. About half the red lights in the cockpit are on. But amazingly, the airplane, when I go to level the wings, it responds. Get the wings back level and start doing, go through the procedure to just determine how much the extent of damage control, I guess you could say. And the procedure was you usually start from the back left side of the panels and just come on around with your eyes.
Mm-hmm.
And in a B-52, you had 10 hydraulic packs, and they sit right to the left. If you just dropped your hand down in the seat, you'd drop your hand on the hydraulic panels, and there were 10 red lights, one red light for each hydraulic pack, and about half of those red lights were on. The procedure was to go ahead and shut them down, but I just looked and saw, okay, I've lost about half the hydraulics. And then I kept coming around into the front of the instrument panel, and I see number 3 and 4 engine fire lights are on.
Mm-hmm.
So I took a quick look out my window, and, yep, number 3 and 4 engines are both on fire. So I pull the T-handles for those two engines, shut the throttles down, and then I look in front of the co-pilot, and he has a big, what we call a master firelight in front of the co-pilot, and that meant that somewhere in the airplane there was a fire or fires. And the co-pilot over on his side had about 20 little panels that would break out where the fire was.
Yes.
But
mm-hmm.
I can't see that as a pilot. I couldn't see that. All I could see was a big red light.
Mm-hmm.
But just as I'm looking at that red light is when the second SAM hit the airplane. And this time, the airplane goes up in about a 30-degree bank once again. And the same thing, I'm able to level the wings. But another thing that happens is we now have explosive decompression. We've taken a hit in the pressurized compartment, so now we're unpressurized, and the noise level just goes tremendously high, and I'm sure it's because of wherever we were hit, the air was rushing through there and making all this noise. So that's one thing I remember, was the noise was just deafening. And the way I describe it is if you were standing next to a railroad tracks and the train went by about 70 or 80 miles an hour, that's what that sounded like. But I got rid of one of my problems because everything was dark. It went completely black, so I got rid of all the red lights. They were gone. And so the airplane is now stable, and I just look out to check on those engine fires, and now the wing's on fire. So here we are. We were just seconds away from our target, which was downtown Hanoi, Bach Mai Airfield, and so now it's decision time. What do we do? Do we stay with this thing or do we get out of it? And what really concerned me, I wasn't that concerned about the hydraulic packs or the two engines. What concerned me was the wing fire, because I knew in this model B-52, the D model,
mm-hmm.
that the ejection seats, for some reason, were very reliable if you were in a 1G configuration, but they were not very reliable if you were in a high G load.
Can you describe just quickly the difference between those two?
Yes, the 1G is like you and I are sitting right now. We're in a 1G configuration right now. One times...
Gravity at its...
Gravity
right.
times one, which
yes.
is normal.
Right.
But then when you have an adverse or an abnormal G load, that would be either negative or positive G's. And if that wing snapped and the airplane went, then the airplane is automatically uncontrollable. And now you could very easily be in a high G load situation. Mm. And ejections in that airplane in the high G configuration were not very reliable. The seats tend to hang up when they fire. They don't totally clear the airplane. Mm. And whether it was a problem with the rocket motor or whether it was a track design problem, I don't know. But whatever.
But you were aware of this.
I was aware of that. Mm-hmm. And so I'm thinking, if I don't get them out now, probably all of us aren't going to make it out. And
did you have communications inside
the
aircraft?
No, communication. Mm-hmm. And this is when I'm sure that one of the things that was that I was weighing was that briefing item. Because now that's an option to bail out, whereas before, in my mind, it wasn't an option. But now it clearly is. So finally I decide I've got to get them out now, and it was so frustrating because I know I'm only 8 or 9 minutes from the Gulf of Tonkin. If we go east, and particularly with that jet stream, we're only 8 or 9 minutes from being over the Gulf, and if we're over the Gulf and eject, will be picked up by friendlies because mm-hmm. we own the Gulf of Tonkin. Mm-hmm. So that is driving me, but I'm thinking we'll never make it. We will never make it with that wing fire.
And are you thinking that the fuel supply, was the fuel supply in the wing? I'm assuming
it
was.
You have uh-huh. fuel in the wing. But I wasn't, the biggest concern I had was that wing snapping.
Snapping off.
And going uncontrollable.
Right.
That was my biggest concern. But that was definitely that could have happened, Laura. You're absolutely right. With fuel in the wings, that could have easily, you know, it could have exploded. And it kind of looks like it did as we got after-action reports from, I was Blue 1, Blue 2, just saw a huge fireball. And so did my navigator and gunner. But that's still to come, that story.
Okay.
But anyway, I'm here trying to make this decision on whether to stay in or get out. So I finally decide I've got to get them out. So Boeing, in their infinite wisdom, when they built the airplane, assuming that you could have a complete electrical power failure,
mm-hmm.
which really is a misnomer. That's what we referred to it. That's what we referred to as a complete electrical power failure. But like my old aircraft commander used to say, you don't have a complete electrical power failure until your battery goes out, until your flashlight doesn't work anymore. And at any rate, Boeing... Mm-hmm. But what drove everything electrically on the airplane were alternators, and we had lost all of our alternators, and that's why everything was black in the airplane. But, of course, the airplane has a battery, eh?
Mm-hmm.
And it does power certain critical things, like emergency lighting for basic instruments, like an altimeter, an airspeed indicator, a turn indicator, and a heading indicator. You just have seven little lights that are powered by that battery. And the other thing that you have is power to an emergency bailout light. And it's like the red light I told you in front of the co-pilot for fire.
Yes.
Well, each crew position had a big red light like that in front of their crew position. And in the event that you had complete electrical power failure, almost complete electrical power failure, you still have a battery.
Right.
The pilot has a switch that he can activate, which will turn that light on. And you as a crew member, if you see that red light come on, you're cleared to eject. Normal ejection in a B-52 is over interphone. The pilot says, bail out, bail out, bail out, and then there's an order in which you bail out. And
you mean a sequence?
A sequence, uh-huh, that's right, uh-huh. Sure is. In fact, the sequence was, I think the EW went first, which is an upward ejection, then the navigator ejected downward, then the radar navigator ejected downward, then the gunner, he didn't have an ejection seat. He had explosive bolts on his turret, and he would fire those explosive bolts, which just released the turret, the gun turret. It just fell away, and then the gunner just fell out that open hole there.
He fell out along with the gun.
Yeah, he didn't really go with the guns. The guns went, which
right.
left an opening for him.
Oh, okay, for
and then
him
he
to...
just stepped out of his seat, and he was gone.
Okay.
And then the co-pilot and then the pilot. That's the normal ejection order
mm-hmm.
or sequence.
Mm-hmm.
But in this event, when you have to use the light, then it's go when the light comes on. You don't worry about sequence. You just bail out.
Mm-hmm.
And as it turns out, as we reconstituted the crime later, the first person out of the airplane was E.W. And boy, he went quick. I mean, I turned that light on, and it seemed to me like it was less than a second later I heard a seat fire. And then I'm listening for the next two seats to fire, the navigator and the radar, and I wait, and I wait, and I wait, and I don't hear anything. And I'm thinking, I'm probably hyperventilating to the extent that they probably did eject, and I just didn't hear them. And the noise level was so high anyway, I said, I probably just didn't hear them. So I motioned to the co-pilot to eject. Well, he shook his head, no, and with his hand was indicating, hey, we're straight and level. And I'm saying to myself, that's right, David, but we've got a wing on fire, but there's no way he knows that.
He can't see it.
He can't see it, and I can't tell him.
So
that's when I ejected. And funny, talking to David later, he said, he looked over there right after I ejected, and he thought, oh, my God, he's serious. He said, I'd better go help him. He's going to need my help. He said he estimates about a second later he ejected. As best we can determine, the aircraft commander for a short time was either the navigator or the gunner. It was a tie between those two. And the reason is, and this is all stuff I found out, of course, afterwards.
Oh, sure.
The navigator, the new guy on the crew,
yes,
along with the gunner, right out of nav school, his seat malfunctioned. It didn't fire. He pulls the D-ring, or he pulls the lanyard, and the seat doesn't fire. Fortunately, the radar navigator realizes what his problem is, and he does the right thing, and he ejects so that the navigator has a hole that he can manually bail out of.
So he can actually undo his restraints?
That's what he had to do, undo his seat belt, shoulder harness, stand up, get out of that seat, step to the side and bail out of that open where that radar seat had just been, which he did. So the time it took him to unstrap, get out, and manually bail out. Now the gunner, what he's experiencing is, he's not believing it when he sees the red light come on, because the airplane's not doing anything dramatic. It's not out of control. And he, of course, lost all of his lighting and electrical, but he didn't have the explosive decompression. He's still pressurized back there. So he doesn't see things as being that bad. And he said when he saw the light, he couldn't believe it, that I was telling him to bail out. And but about that time, he looked outside and saw the flames coming back from the wing fire. And that's when he decided maybe he better go.
Maybe you were giving him the right
signal. Yeah, maybe
signal.
I was giving him the right idea. So, any rate, we don't know for sure who was the last one out of the airplane, but we know it was either the gunner or the navigator. But one of those two were the last ones out. Both of them, by the way, when their chutes opened, saw the airplane fireball to blow up in the air.
You did not see that, though, John.
I did not see that, no. What I saw was, well, the first problem I had was there's an emergency oxygen bottle on the parachutes put there just for a situation like we were in, where you're going to have to bail out at 35 or 40,000 feet, since there's very little oxygen at that altitude.
Right. You could pass out. You'll just pass out.
Yeah. Yeah.
Presumably.
So, well, that was the theory.
Okay.
So to preclude that, life support had put on all parachutes this emergency oxygen supply bottle, just a little pressurized bottle that was sewn into this parachute harness. And to activate that, the way that bottle activated, you had to manually activate it with what we called a green apple, and that's exactly what it looked like. About the size of a ping pong ball, made out of wood on a wire cable. When you pulled that green apple, it sheared a nipple on that bottle and allowed that pressurized oxygen to go through a little hose, just a small little hose that went from the bottle to your oxygen mask. And that was the idea. If you had to bail out, that you'd have that emergency oxygen supply when you were descending, pre-falling.
Right.
However, there's a problem with that green apple. When you're in that airplane, in that seat, with that seatbelt and shoulder harness on, plus you've got water survival equipment on, plus you've got a survival vest which has flares in it, your weapon, your 38, and all kinds of your radio,
yes.
Your survival radio.
Yes.
Okay, you get the picture. You got all this stuff on. And to find that green apple was a challenge. In fact, I used to, particularly on missions out of Guam, after we dropped our bombs and heading back to Guam,
mm-hmm.
I'd sit there and just practice saying, well, what if I had to bail out? And what if, let's go through the steps. So I would. What was the thing I could never find by feel? That damn green apple. I could never find that stupid thing. I'd always have to turn a light on and see it to find it. Well, I wrote up an OHR on that, Operational Hazardous Report, which didn't change anything. Nothing ever changed, but it just really irritated me before the war. Well, now as it turns out, when I eject, of course, I didn't even think about that thing. But after I ejected, well, the first problem was upon ejection
mm-hmm.
is all at once I feel something pull away from me. And I thought, oh, what the hell was that? And then I thought, that was my chute. I've lost my chute. It's over. Then I realized, no, you idiot, that was your ejection seat.
The chair.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And you want to lose that because
right.
That's a lot of metal. But there have been people that have died. They've successfully ejected from the plane. Their chute opens successfully, and they get a death grip on those hand grips and hold onto the seat right into the ground. So you'd want to get rid of that seat.
Okay.
And I do. But now I think, oh, I'm at 35,000 feet. I got to activate that oxygen bottle. Same old story. I couldn't find that stupid green apple. So my flight path and my free fall was not the way they teach you. They teach you to arch your back, spread your arms, and be in a controlled free fall. My free fall I'd describe as if you blew up a balloon and released it, the flight path of that balloon, that was kind of mine.
Because essentially you're grasping around trying to find
the green apple.
Mm-hmm.
Now I'm getting upset with mm-hmm. this stupid green apple. The chute opens, and the chute opens at 14,000 feet automatically. I know that I no longer need oxygen, but by God, I'm going to pull that green apple, and I mean when I pull it, it is going to be pulled. And I finally find that stupid thing, and I just pull it for all it's worth. So here I am, probably about to die, and I'm still mad about some stupid green apple. But you wouldn't believe the satisfaction I had when I found that green apple and pulled it. I just to myself said, there, take that, you stupid thing. So anyway, now back to business. Here I am at 14,000 feet. All I can see is that undercast I was telling you about that was there every night.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, I can see stuff. I can see small arms fire. I can see the muzzle flash. And I'm thinking, how can I keep this chute airborne and just float out to the Gulf of Tonkin?
Can you see any of your crew members?
No, I didn't. I saw no crew members.
Okay.
And the only thing I remember seeing were small arms fire, the
mm-hmm.
muzzle flashes.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, I thought, how can they miss? You know, here I am just hanging in the chute. They probably didn't even see me. They're probably just shooting. I don't know. But at any rate, I come through the undercast, never saw the ground, and that's an abrupt stop.
Boy,
the parachuting is okay, not bad. But what I enjoyed, one of the things that I really enjoyed when that chute opened was for the first time in about 3 minutes, it was quiet, relatively quiet. And that wind through the chute just sounded so good after that extreme noise level that I'd had just before that. So anyway, I hit the ground, and I'm stunned with the landing. But I do remember standing up, looking around, and I can see I'm close to a barn in a farm yard. And I stand up, I'm taking my helmet off, and as I take my helmet off, I can hear voices. And about that time, there's about a dozen Vietnamese that come around the corner of this barn. And I'd say maybe two or three of them are armed.